Good evening, everyone, and again, a wonderful turnout. Thank you so much for being here. It is truly with great pleasure that I welcome you to the beautiful Monterey Conference Center in our wonderful city of Monterey for the second evening and event of the Leon Panetta 2015 Lecture Series. As you know, this year we're focusing on the issues and the debates that pose the crucial challenges to our nation. They're the kinds of debates where there is no easy solution and in which supporters on each side of the subject feel passionately about their point of view. In short, these are the critical issues that are testing leadership in 2015. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "A genuine leader is not a searcher for consensus, but a molder of consensus." As we prepare to discuss the topic of race relations, Dr. King's observation rings powerfully true. This past year has seen headline after headline describing incidents of violence between law enforcement and minority communities and responding protests. In light of these events, it's unclear if we are continuing to make progress on the civil rights issues that Dr. King fought for more than 50 years ago, or if we are regressing. Can we move past the tragedies in Ferguson, in New York City, and in North Charleston? And can we work toward improved relations between races? How can we improve trust between minority communities and law enforcement? Can we address issues of equality without discussion about broader policy issues like education, like poverty, and like employment opportunity? Most importantly, when will we see the kind of leadership on this issue that Dr. King described? Leadership that is actively engaged in bringing all aspects of the issue together and working to build, not simply discover a solution. What should be the role of government? What should be the role of community activists? What should be the role of the courts? And what should be the role of the criminal justice system in ensuring that Dr. King's work continues to progress? Tonight, Secretary Panetta will discuss this issue with the civil rights leader. He'll discuss it with a law enforcement officer, and he'll discuss it with a leading Latino voice in politics and in the justice system. Our first guest is the youngest person ever to lead the NAACP. A Monterey Peninsula native, he began his career opening mail with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He then spent 15 years as an investigative reporter and community organizer, leading successful state and local movements to ban the death penalty, to outlaw racial profiling, to defend voting rights, to secure marriage equality, and to reform mass incarceration. At 35, he was appointed national president and CEO of the NAACP, where he oversaw the launch of programs on education, on health, and on environmental justice. His edited collection of essays called Reach, 40 Black Men Speak on Living, Learning, and Succeeding was published in February. Please welcome Ben Jealous. Welcome, my dear. Our second guest has a 50-year career in public service and is one of the world's most highly esteemed leaders in law enforcement. A Marine with a combat tour in Vietnam, he is a 43-year veteran of the NYPD, where he first joined the department in 1963. He was appointed to the Office of Commissioner in 1992, and he served for 2 years. In 2002, he was appointed again and served until 2013, making him the longest-serving police commissioner in the city's history. In his second term, he created the first counterterrorism bureau of any municipal police department in the country. Under his leadership, violent crime in New York City declined 40% from the 2001 levels. He has been lauded for his excellence in leadership and will soon release his memoir, Vigilance: My Life Serving America and Protecting Its Empire City. Please welcome Ray Kelly. Our final guest is one of America's most prominent Latino politicians and was the first to win a statewide office in Colorado. Elected Attorney General in 1987, he investigated sexual assault allegations against the University of Colorado football program and the homicide of a Native American man in southwestern Colorado. He also reviewed law enforcement matters relating to the Columbine High School killings. Elected to the U.S. Senate in 2004, he was a bipartisan leader on comprehensive immigration reform, a leader on legislation to end the war in Iraq, and a leader on preliminary regulations leading to health care reform. In 2008, President Obama selected him to serve as Secretary of the Interior, where he provided strong leadership in protecting the nation's natural resources. Please welcome Ken Salazar.
Thank you, Sarah.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And of course, moderating the discussion is the man who created this lecture series 18 years ago, the chairman of the Panetta Institute, former director of the CIA, and former Secretary of Defense. Early in his political career in 1969, he was appointed director of the U.S. Office for Civil Rights, where he was responsible for enforcing equal education laws. Trust me, he knows firsthand the kind of leadership this topic demands. Please welcome Secretary Leon E. Panetta.
Thank you very much, and good evening, everyone, and welcome to this, our second forum of our lecture series. The theme that we focused on was the theme of looking at the challenges of leadership in 2015 and those critical issues that can unite or divide America. We talked in our first forum about energy. In the next forums, we'll talk about the economy and cyber. And tonight, we focus on a very challenging issue, which is the issue of race relations. What a tragic few weeks we've had in this country, with the images that we've seen on television, on the front pages of newspapers across the country. In our democracy, we are committed to equal justice for all. That's what the United States is all about. But at the same time, as it says at the top of the Supreme Court, we are a nation of laws, not men. And we expect that those laws will be fairly and effectively enforced in order to preserve order in our society. There is this critical balance we've often talked about between protecting our freedoms and protecting our security. I've always believed that we could do both. And that's really part of the challenge we face today. We are, at the same time, a racially diverse nation. Diversity is at the heart of what America is all about. We're a land of immigrants. We have people from across the world that have become part of this great country. And in many ways, that diversity is our great strength. But it can also be a weakness if we allow discrimination to prevail in our country. The challenge is, can we move forward as a country? And the fact is, we have made great progress. We had to go through a civil war. We had to fight a number of actions that really divided people in this country. We went through the civil rights movement. We've made progress. After all, we have the first black president in the history of this country. We have a black attorney general. And the fact is that we've had progress across this country. An Italian American became Secretary of Defense and Director of the CIA. A Latino became Secretary of Interior, as well as a United States Senator. And someone who, you know, is descends from Irish immigrants who came to this country, Ray Kelly, became Commissioner of Police in New York City, biggest city in this country. And a hometown kid, African-American from Pacific Grove, became the head of the NAACP. The fact is that The fact is progress has been made. But again, those images that we've seen over these last few weeks have in many ways shaken our confidence and turned things upside down. And so first question I want to ask is, when we look at Ferguson, when we look at New York City, we look at Fort Lauderdale and Cleveland and other cities, and in particular what happened in North Charleston, which was something that I think is seared into our memory of a white police officer shooting a black man running away from him. And it's something that I think has really shaken this country. The question I have is, what's happening? What does this all mean? Is this the exception? The bad apples that are, you know, obviously being filmed on video? Is it the rule? I mean, is it the kind of behavior that police engage in all the time, and now we're obviously seeing some of it on video? Or is it symptomatic of perhaps something worse in our society, that our society is becoming more divided and that race relations are getting worse rather than better? What's happening? Ray?
First, let me point out that at one time, the New York City Police Department was all Irish immigrants. So I had a bit of a leg up. From my perspective, being in law enforcement for a long time, I think the law enforcement community in this country has never been more professional, never better educated, never better trained, never more diverse, and never more restrained in the use of force, and certainly never more sensitive to the issue of civil rights. Still, there are issues, there are problems. When you see the horrific events, when you see that video from North Ferguson, understandably, people are going to say, this is suspicions confirmed. This is what happens with great regularity. We just were fortunate to have a camera there and look at this. So that's sort of what is confronting law enforcement. There's a lot of introspection going on now with chiefs that I talk to. There's no easy answers. Understandably, people question police, question those types of practices. I think some of the things that we should look at more proactively is to diversify departments. We know the story of Ferguson, where the city is two-thirds African-American. We have 53 police officers, three are people of color. Those types of stories, unfortunately, are out there in fairly large numbers in police departments. New York City, we're proud of our diversity. We have police officers born in 106 countries, but that was the result of a very aggressive recruiting, and that's what has to be done. Racial profiling is an issue, no question about it. I think it does go on, but it goes on perhaps to a much lesser degree than people might think. I think a lot of things that go on that people think are racial profiling are really criminal profiling. I have a problem with the benchmark that's used in this regard. A lot of times it's just census data comparing people who have contact with the police with the census and with the demographics of a city in general. And quite frankly, the causes of crime are the ones that we generally accept as the causes of crime. Poverty, lack of educational opportunities, lack of job opportunities, dysfunctional families are not equally distributed in our society. So the police response to crime is not equally distributed as well. I think we should have a different benchmark, which we talked about earlier, and that benchmark, it was something devised for the NYPD by the RAND Corporation, that we should look at the description of the perpetrators of violent crime given by the victims of violent crime. Government is out of it. And you use that as sort of a benchmark as to whether or not racial profiling is ongoing. There's lots of other things that I think should be done. I think educational standards should be raised for police officers. I think more psychological testing has to be done. And obviously, training. We're proud of the training we did in NYPD. Other places simply don't have the resources to do that. But even with the training, there's no guarantees. We're dealing with human beings who can make errors, who have to make split-second decisions. Again, to answer the Secretary's question, I think there's an infinitesimal number of police officers who engage in activities similar to certainly the type that we've seen in North Charleston. But that's my opinion. That's from over 40 years in policing, and I understand that people can question that, and we've got a lot of work to do to gain back the confidence of the community.
Ben?
You know, look, I think we have to look at the numbers sort of in different ways and turn them around. And one of the ones that we have a hard time escaping is that everybody that we're talking about who's been shot by the cops and recently is black, right? That's what we just keep seeing over and over. It's some black guy getting shot. And in each case, in each case what we're talking about, they're unarmed. Many of them weren't even suspected of being criminals in anything that would ever rank with, anything that the commissioner would agree was. Like, you take Johnny Crawford, right? We forget about his case and Tamir Rice. These are the Ohio cases that happened after Mike Brown, before Eric Garner, and they just don't compute. Because when you look at the video, Johnny Crawford's in a Walmart aisle buying a Red Ryder BB gun. He's leaning on it like a cane, so it's not even pointing. He's talking to his mother on his cell phone. The police officer walks around the corner on the Walmart video and shoots and kills him. There's not a word exchanged. Tamir Rice, other side of Ohio, about a week, 2 weeks later, may have even been a month, little boy playing with a BB gun in a park. Police officer drives up, doesn't say a word, shoots and kills him. We don't see that happen to white boys, and there are a lot more white boys in our society, and a lot more white men than black. And in prison, for instance, there's roughly equal numbers of white men and black men. Blacks are overrepresented, but as far as raw numbers in the country, they're roughly equal. So we have to deal with that, right? We have to deal with the fact that we have a problem in killing innocent black men in our society that we just simply don't have across the board. Then we also have to deal with the fact that while we may feel very afraid about crime in our society, crime rates are at an all-time low since like the mid-1960s. So our crime is actually inverse to what, our fear is inverse to what's happening with crime. And then we have to deal with the fact that in many of our big cities across this country, we're solving fewer homicides than we were when crime was higher, a lower percentage. And so there's a real need for us, I think, Leon, as a society, to just admit some things. And one of them is that even though killings are going down, homicides are going down, officer killings of civilians are going down, civilian killings of officers are going down, video is revealing that we have a resistant problem that we used to be able to cover up, because they could say he reached for my gun, or he was running towards me and then he suddenly turned away. They lied. Bad officers, not the majority, but a few bad officers got away for centuries in our country with lying. And they're being caught on videotape. And we just need to be honest about that fact and deal with it. And the reality is, Gray and I agree, look, we need personality testing so that people who are bullies in their personal lives don't become police officers in our public lives. We need training so that every officer in this country is trained as well as the NYPD, which is a standard of once every 6 months. In most jurisdictions, in the 16,000 police departments in this country, what's most common is you're trained once at the academy and that's it. We need more options as far as technology, but we also have to be honest with ourselves that we have a problem of bias, implicit as it often is, towards black men in our society that results in lethal outcomes for innocent people in a way that we simply don't see with other racial groups.
Ken?
I think Secretary Panetta and all of you who are here in Monterey today, I would say that what happened in the last year and all these incidents is essentially just a manifestation of what is in America today, that there's still racism and it's still a reality with police departments and community police relations. And I think what's happened in the last year is that it's become much more prevalent because of the fact that everybody has an iPhone, you're always on camera, so it's been a lot easier to detect the same kind of activity that would have been occurring for the last several hundred years. And so when I look at these issues, Mr. Secretary, I look at it from the perspective of the history of the United States of America. You look back 400 years ago, and it was about annihilation of populations. It was about killing Native Americans and killing people who were different. You look at it in the Mexican-American War and the Civil War, and it was about enslavement of people because they were different. You have 600,000 Americans killed in the Civil War. That gives rise to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, but that still has 100 years of history that has to unfold before you get to Brown versus the Board of Education. And you get Brown versus the Board of Education, we sit here tonight, you know, 50 years from the march at Selma, and have we made progress in that time frame from 50 years ago to now, from 100 years ago to now? And I would say yes. And so I think what we're seeing today with the events at Ferguson and North Carolina and New York City and so many other places is just that people are being caught, police are being caught doing things that have been going on for a very long time. And in my view, from my time as Attorney General of my state, where I oversaw 14,000 peace officers, now we're little in Colorado. We don't have 50 or 60,000 people like they do in New York City, see? So we have 14,000 peace officers. But what we did as Attorney General is we recognized racial profiling was an issue. We recognized as well that there were huge disparities in what the big cities like Denver and Colorado Springs could do versus all the other hundreds of small jurisdictions. And so we developed training programs. And I think what Commissioner Kelly has said is so correct, and that is that we need to train law enforcement to be able to understand the communities that they're policing. So training is one, and then the second is, yeah, when you have a situation like in Ferguson, 75% African-American community, 3 out of the 50-some people who are actually African-American, how can you have effective policing? And so the concept of diversity in your police ranks, I think, is one of the most important things that could be done across America.
Let me ask you, Ray, on something that, you know, it concerned me when I saw this. Because, I mean, we ask ourselves, is this a white versus black problem? But I guess what I'm wondering is it a blue problem? Because we had this event in San Bernardino where an NBC News helicopter captured the end of a chase, and it was a white man who was fleed on horseback, of all things, a taser.
San Bernardino, yeah.
They were, yeah, this is the Wild West. The taser knocked him off of the horse and he went to the ground and he was clearly subdued. There were 11 sheriff's deputies around him and they kicked him about 17 times, punched him 37 times, and there were 13 blows to the head. What struck me is nobody yelled stop. Nobody said, you know, took charge of the situation. And I guess I need to understand it from your own experience. Is this adrenaline? Is it fear? Is it, you know, bad training? Is it mob mentality? How do you explain what happened and how do you prevent that kind of thing?
Well, first of all, it's absolutely wrong. You can't tolerate that as an agency. They apparently chased this individual for 3 hours. Mm. It was a long chase, and they were frustrated by it, and that's what you saw. The adrenaline was coming out. You cannot excuse that in any way, but I think that's what drove it. They have to be disciplined, of course. But it's also interesting that I don't know what they thought that helicopter was doing, but hey, somebody should have taken a look up and said, "No, let's not do this.
We need intelligence tests."
So yeah, right.
It's a training,
raise
right?
those standards. So it was just emotion. It's wrong, but it does happen in policing. They're human beings. They make mistakes, and this was, you can see they had invested a lot, they expended a lot, and they wanted to punish him.
Yeah, no, obviously. Let me, I don't want to ride away on horseback. Ben, let me tell you, it was raised, this whole issue of racial profiling. It's a term we often use today in terms of identifying people who are identified by virtue of their race as opposed to their behavior. But bias-based policing has gone on a long time in this country. It goes back to the Revolution. Obviously African Americans as slaves, Jim Crow, were profiled. We had Mexicans and Latinos coming out of the war against Mexico. Since that time, Italians and Irish competing for jobs faced discrimination in a number of ways. Chinese, as you mentioned earlier, there was a law passed that basically stopped the Chinese from being able to be citizens in this country. Japanese, 110,000 were interned after Pearl Harbor. Muslims after 9/11 obviously have been targeted in many ways because of what happened on 9/11. And even here in Salinas, near Monterey here, 90% of the gang problem is probably centered in the Latino. It is centered in the Latino community. Sure. So the question I have is, how do you fairly enforce the law without racial profiling if the focus of enforcement by its very nature involves largely one minority?
You have to focus on behavior. There's nothing about the complexion of a suspect that, or a group of suspects, that changes the fundamentals of good law enforcement. And indeed, what we find is that when we get fixated by what people look like rather than what they do, we make bad decisions. When you're talking about criminal networks, for instance, there's this thing called carnival theory, which says that if you have a package you need to get through, it could be a dirty bomb, it could be, a kilo of cocaine. And there's always choke points in our society. It could be an airport, it could be an airport's a good example. It could be a county fair. I mean, there's places where people have to push through. It could be the streets of New York City. You send dummies through, and you take note of who gets stopped and who doesn't get stopped. And then the people who don't get stopped, well, you send them back. Now, how does this work, right? If you, right after 9/11, there was a student named Nathaniel Heatwall. Raise your hand if you recall his name. Anybody know who Nathaniel Heatwall was? All right, one person, former head of the NAACP of our county, recalls his name. Nathaniel Heatwall was a white student who was commuting on Southwest Airlines to Guilford College from BWI down in North Carolina every week. And he was going through at BWI, and one day he notices, I left a box cutter in my backpack, and it didn't get through. Now, guys who look like me, like vaguely Arab, well, in this period, we had our hands up every time we went through BWI. At one point, I asked the officer if my license said that my middle name was Random, because he kept telling me he was doing random searches, and he kept stopping me. And meanwhile, Nathaniel Heatwall throws his backpack with his box cutter, and it goes through, and he says, well, that's kind of weird. So, well, let me just leave it in there, see what happens. Next time, it goes right through. Next time, it goes right through. He throws a few more in there. It goes right through. He goes back to his college. He says to somebody in the criminal justice program, what's that stuff? It's not actually C4 plastic explosive, but on an x-ray, it looks like it. It's totally inert, but it looks like it. Get me some of that. He throws that in the backpack. Goes right through. Then he says, you know what? The tail number on the jet's always the same. I'm going to tape some of these box cutters in the vanity in the bathroom and see what happens. Comes back next week, they're still there. Then he writes a note on it and puts it on his backpack. He says, this is who I am. This is what I've done. This is what you haven't done. This is where you can find me. Please come find me so we can talk about this. And then they arrest him. Right, left his note on his backpack in the overhead with the fake plastic explosive and the actual box cutters. That's what happens. The same thing happens on the street. You know, when we were debating over stop and frisk in New York City, there were a couple of things that you really had to kind of come to terms with. One of them was plainly said in the New York Times. There was an officer going down a street with a suspect specific description. A rapist who was believed to be in the area. He encounters four women on their stoop talking, young ladies. They say they haven't seen the rapist, so then he stops and frisks them. When he started to stop and frisk those four young ladies, he had stopped looking for the rapist. It can have profound effect in our society, and I'll just close on this. 100 years ago, we learned this lesson, long before that we figured out that the DC snipers were black, even though we spent 2 weeks looking for a white guy and all that stuff. President McKinley was working a rape line. President McKinley was working a rope line at an expo north of New York City right after he was re-elected. And he was shot twice in the stomach before somebody in the crowd tackled the assailant, and the third bullet glanced off to the side. At the time, the profile of a would-be presidential assassin was an Eastern European anarchist. That was the scenario everybody was prepared for. And the racial sort of characteristics were that the person would be swarthy, tall, and have exotic facial hair. The shooter who was captured was blonde, blue-eyed, 5'8". He had a gun hidden in a crudely faked bandage when he was tackled. The Secret Service agent in charge of the expo came over and, according to the records, interviewed the guy in charge of the rope line and said, what happened? The shooter walked right past you with a gun in his hand. You were supposed to check everybody going to the rope line head to toe with your hands. How'd you let this happen? So, well, boss, he looked like any other mechanic out for a day at the fair. And it looked like he had a bad arm, so we didn't want to hurt his arm. Now, the guy was an actual Eastern European anarchist. He just apparently didn't look like the stereotype. His name was Leon Czolgosz. He said, but boss, we think he had a decoy, because right behind him, there was a tall, swarthy man with exotic facial hair. And we checked him again and again and again and again, and we didn't find anything on him, but he definitely distracted us from the shooter. He said, by all means, go find the decoy, boys. Come back. They got good news, they got bad news. So what's the good news? He said, well, we found that tall, swarthy man with exotic facial hair. Well, then what's the bad news? That's Constable Big John Parker. The light-skinned black retired constable who tackled the shooter before our boys could get there. That's the danger. When we decide, oh, all the gang members are black, or all the gang members are brown, or all the terrorists are Arab. Don't forget about Oklahoma City, right? Where they went around looking for Arabs while Timothy McVeigh drove away. No. If you're an officer, you are required to keep all of us safe. You focus on the behavior. And if you get tripped up on how I look, I'll sue you.
Ray, do you want to comment on this?
The question was again?
You don't have to. That's all right.
I thought we were going to keep
going. I think Ben has hit the nail on the head. Ken, let me ask you, immigration reform. Because in immigration, obviously we know the immigration situation is broken in this country. We've been talking about it. There's a tremendous need for immigration reform. At the same time, I guess state and local communities are beginning to do more of the enforcement on immigration because they say the feds are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And as a result, talk about racial profiling. I think a lot of that is taking place. You were a U.S. senator. You worked on immigration laws. Is it just a reality that immigration reform is not going to happen in the near future?
So, Leon, I have high hopes that it'll happen. I don't know whether it'll happen before the 2016 election or it'll happen after that, but I think that the forces of this country ultimately will deliver on a comprehensive immigration reform package because we can't afford to have the broken system that we have in place now. And I had the honor of, I've worked with you on the cabinet with President Obama, and we were champions when Senator Obama and I were in the Senate of the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Package, where you had Senator John McCain and you had Senator Ted Kennedy and a group of about eight of us that actually were successful in getting a package of immigration reform legislation through. Yet it was killed in the House of Representatives, and I've watched very closely over time what's happened in this country in terms of the impasse that we have on immigration reform. And I would say this, that local governments, state governments, trying to take over the immigration system and enforcement is wrong, because immigration really is a national issue and it ought to be resolved at the national level. But I think apropos to this particular conversation, where we're talking about race in the community policing context, I think that the reason that we have an impasse in this country on immigration reform is frankly rooted in racism. And I think it's rooted in the racism that exists with respect to the southern border. You know, I remember being on the floor of the Senate for some 60 days or so straight with Senator Kennedy and our Democratic and Republican colleagues trying to kill amendments that were poison pill amendments. We're trying to take the legislation down at the time. And there were those members of the Senate, many of whom are still there, including some from the state of Texas, who wanted to always build a wall between the United States and Mexico because they saw that as a permanent wall between the United States and all of Latin America. And they saw all the bad people coming from the South. And yet, I remember often arguing to them on the floor that there were families like mine that had been around in what is now the United States for 400 years. We were here 250 years in California and New Mexico and Texas and Colorado long before there was the United States of America. And so my own view is that when you compare what's happened in the southern border to what's happened in the northern border, is that there's a complete disparate treatment. You look at the northern border, it's about 5,000 miles. Very few border patrol officers are stationed up there. And yet we have almost 100 times more the number of border patrols stationed on the southern border. Why? It is because there's a history that stems back to the Mexican-American War, the creation of a wall, if you will, between the United States and Latin America, that I know President Bush tried very hard to deal with that issue and to try to create more unity and an understanding of community between Mexico and the United States. I know President Obama has worked on it very hard, but there still is in Texas and in Arizona and in lots of places in this country an anti-immigrant view that I think is founded on those historical roots that have a lot to do with racism. So here's my hope, and I expect that it will happen post 2016, that the angels that want to create a just system, a system that is not founded on breaking the law, will act to uphold the moral values of this country. We are an immigrant nation, and we should uphold the value that here in the United States of America, we should not tolerate families being broken apart or 11 million people living in the shadows of our society. I sometimes wonder what would happen here in California or in Colorado or any of the 50 states of the United States if all of a sudden you didn't have the landscapers, the people who are out there building our homes, the people who are out there changing our linen in our hotel rooms. What would happen if they were to be kicked out? You know, this economy would go into a tailspin. And so why have we as a country been so stuck in this paralysis where we cannot move forward with comprehensive immigration reform? I think it has to do a lot with the same issue that we're talking about here tonight. And I would just add one thing on the racial profiling issue. I think that racial profiling has always been an issue in policing, and I think it's an issue today. But I think at the end of the day, it is about training police officers to be sensitive to the differences in communities. And I think that's why it's so important to have police agencies that are inclusive. Because if you are a Latino that has come from the barrio, and you are out there policing the people in that community, you know how better to relate to them and how to deal with the very issue that Ben just raised so eloquently, and that it's about behavior. It's not about how you look.
Okay. Can I just add something about immigration enforcement? And I think it's unwise for state and local authorities to be involved in that. There's a prohibition in New York against police officers asking about one's immigration status. The reason for that is, first of all, it is a federal obligation, but secondly, You want people who are victims of crime to come forward to feel free to report. You want, as a police agency, information from that universe of people. If you are involved in immigration enforcement, forget it. Nobody will approach you.
Yeah. Ray, let me ask you about stop and frisk. Mayor Bloomberg and you, I think you credit, obviously, the decline in the crime rate in New York City as a result of a large increase in the number of police stops that took place under this so-called stop and frisk. And there was a significant reduction, about 40% reduction in the level of crime in New York City. As a consequence, it became obviously very controversial. The district court judge that found it unconstitutional, it was appealed, and as I understand it, the appeal was not continued, and they came to some kind of settlement involving a monitor for the use of that approach. Give me your views on the effectiveness and kind of the legal and political consequences involved with stop and frisk.
Well, there's a lot of information. I'll try to cut it short. What is stop, question, and frisk? First of all, the term is pejorative. Ideally, it would be field reports or contact reports, that sort of thing, as it is in other cities. This is a common law right, if you will, the constable to stop and ask people who are engaged in suspicious activity what they're doing. That's what you pay your police officers to do. This practice was validated with Supreme Court case Terry versus Ohio in 1968. It is authorized virtually in every state in the union. What is authorized? To stop someone who you have reasonable suspicion to believe that this person is about to commit, is committing, or has committed a crime. As I say, this is across the board. I never said it was the be-all and end-all. I think it's a valuable tool that should be in a police officer's toolbox. I also believe that the numbers of stops in New York City did not go up dramatically. What we did was require much more accurate reporting. When I was a police officer, when I stopped someone, I did not make out the form unless there was a problem. And the numbers in 1999, when this litigation started, were 92,000 stops. Yes, they went up to 685,000 stops. Sounds like a lot of stops. The New York City Police Department has 23 million contacts a year with its citizens. By the way, the stop rate was four times greater in Chicago and significantly greater when this litigation went forward in Baltimore and Philadelphia. In the lawsuit itself, the judge uses the flimsiest of evidence to indict the whole police department for something called indirect racial profiling. She uses the information from an expert. The expert finds that out of 4 million stops over a decade, only 6% were constitutionally questioned. In the trial itself, the judge looks at 19 stops. She finds that 10 are meet muster as far as constitutionality is concerned. What's the right criteria? We proposed that we use, I mentioned it before, we asked the RAND Corporation in 2006 to give us a reasonable indicator as to whether or not racial profiling is going on. Can't use arrest data, your arrest policies could be fundamentally flawed. Can't use census data, because taken to its logical conclusion, half the stops would be women. What RAND said is, as I said before, look at the descriptions of the perpetrators of violent crime given by the victims of violent crime. In New York City, that runs roughly, let's say, upper 60, 70% African American. The stops traditionally have been of African Americans, 53%. So there is a gap, certainly in that area. The judge would not accept that evidence. She rejected it. The only reason, some of it was accepted as notice to the city that there is a problem. I mentioned we had police officers from 106 countries. No other police department in the world has that. Yet she accused the department of indirect racial profiling. Police officer rank in New York is majority minority. Just a lot of information that wasn't accepted. under the Bloomberg administration, there were 9,500 fewer murders than the 12 years previous. And if history is any guide, the vast majority of those lives saved are young men of color. The judge herself found, as I say, indirect racial profiling. She was removed from the case by the appellate court, who said that she showed partiality in the run-up to the case in statements that she gave. So this was the same appellate court that was going to hear the appeal of the case. Mayor Bloomberg's administration appealed the case. A new mayor was elected, Mayor de Blasio.
I'm going to have to speed it up.
Okay, he decided not to appeal the case. My point is this. You may not like the whole practice of stop and frisk. This case was, in my judgment, a terrible example of justice.
I'll give you a chance to respond.
Sure.
So let me just do this.